Governor Scott Walker has announced that Wisconsin has applied for a federal waiver to be the first state to drug screen and drug test Medicaid recipients. Medicaid is a $9 billion annual program that provides health care to 1 in 5 Wisconsin residents. But how would that drug screening and testing work? And how would a new work or job training requirement also work? Thanks to Michael Heifetz, Wisconsin Medicaid Director, for discussing those changes. Michael, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Why drug test some of our 1.187 million Medicaid recipients, sir?
Well, as you know, this was part of legislation in Act 55, but it is also specifically directed at our childless adults population. Okay. So that's about 149,000 of the 1.1 million that you just mentioned. So
yep.
So we're in the 10 to 15% range. Obviously, this initiative is not for folks who would be unable to work on
yes.
their own and who have other needs that the Medicaid program is meeting for them. But this is specifically targeted at the childless adults because they are, by definition, able to work. And what the governor and other policymakers have heard over the last few years is that there are a lot of jobs here in Wisconsin available, a lot of good-paying jobs, but many of them require a drug test. And I even experienced that very early in my career for a position I was seeking a long time ago. So it's a very reasonable process aimed at helping a subset of our Medicaid population recover from drug abuse, substance use disorder, and move on to productive jobs and family-sustaining jobs so that they won't need Medicaid at all.
Well, thanks for that number. So we're really talking about childless adults, and those numbers are important. So that's 149,000 out of our 1.1 million caseload. So that narrows it.
That narrows it considerably.
You referred to it as a subset.
Right.
My follow-up question is, I saw a number in a Journal Sentinel story that you anticipate, that the agency anticipates 4,000 being drug tested. Is that a number that you're familiar with, or did I misread it?
I have not heard that
okay.
number specifically. It will partially depend on how CMS views our application for these waiver amendments and how they would like our process to operate as we go forward, assuming their approval. We have obviously some optimism with the new administration in that regard, but one never knows for sure. So we're looking forward to that review, but we can't say how many would be tested because there would first be a screen. And the screen obviously is much less of a mechanism, but it does show indications of who might then need to be tested. So it narrows the subset even further. That's what the screening is designed to do, to assess risks of folks who may be having a substance use disorder problem. And then if that screening indicates it, and these screens are clinically indicated, they're models that are used widely. And again, we'll see how CMS views those types of things, but it's not some brand new invention. And if those screens indicate someone should be tested, then they will be tested. But the majority clearly would not be. Probably the vast majority would screen negative.
Would the screen include asking the MA recipient, are you now using drugs? I mean, are you going to use some other indicators pointing to why that person should be screened?
On some of the models we have seen, some of the screens that are out there today and are commonly used, there are those types of questions, almost to the point of what you just said,
okay.
almost verbatim. And then it goes into some other questions as well. Some have 10 questions, some have 20. The clinical world knows all about these screens and their validity and how well they work in this process. And then it leads to the testing.
And if there was a post-screening idea that this person should be that would be a traditional urine test, I assume?
We think so, but again, we will work with CMS to determine how that should work.
And what criteria would the agency use, assuming the federal waiver is approved, for determining who to screen and who to test? Because you just said, I assume you wouldn't screen all 149,000?
We will not screen all 149,000. We will screen a majority of them, however. There will be exemptions for folks who, if they have some kind of category that we use in the Food Share Employment Training Program.
Mm-hmm.
So if they are unable to work for some reason that doesn't put them in a different part of our Medicaid program, then they probably wouldn't be screened. So there will be exemptions to recognize certain circumstances that, you know, any of us could face in life. But for the majority, they would be screened. And then going forward, a smaller group would be tested, a much smaller group in our
much smaller group. But you're not, you don't know whether it'd be 4, 5, 10,000?
We don't.
Okay. You're not basing any models in terms of cost. Who would pay for the cost of the testing?
The Medicaid program pays for the cost.
Okay.
And the Medicaid program will pay for the cost of treatment if it is determined that is necessary as well.
Before we pursue that a little bit more, talk to me about the waiver process. You asked the federal government for waivers. Those have formally been submitted,
correct?
Do the feds have to respond within X number of days? Or
they don't really have to respond within a certain number of days. They are prohibited from responding, I think it's 45 days. So they can't give us an answer before 45 days have expired. They have a 30-day comment period as well, just as we did here at the state level. Mm-hmm. And we did receive hundreds, if not over 1,000 comments on the waiver amendments. So the process is moving along at what we would consider a normal pace, and we look forward to CMS validating that we have a new CMS under this administration. And it's sort of a trust but verify kind of situation. But the initial conversations have been positive, but they can't give us an indication at this point of what they're thinking. And in fact, they will be reaching out to us in the near future, probably after the comment period, but perhaps before, to dig a little deeper into even some of the questions you're asking today, let alone some of the more technical things that they get into.
Potential timelines. When's the earliest that the agency could begin to drug screen and test some of our MA beneficiaries?
In most of the things that we've submitted, we have discussed a one-year implementation period from the time CMS approves. Okay. So I can't tell you what day that would be, and I can't tell you which components, if not all of them, that CMS does eventually approve. But we would still then have a one-year period to fix our systems, to handle the new functions, as well as, and even more importantly, to educate our members and our providers and managed care contractors on how this would all work and work with them to ensure it flows smoothly.
Could it be in place then for fiscal 18-19, the second year of our biennium?
It could be in place for the very back end, but it would probably be the last half of that biennium. Okay. Now, if CMS all of a sudden, day 46, told us go, which is
it's
maybe
possible
not the most
under
likely
the
scenario,
new administration.
It's possible. there has been publicity. They did know this was coming.
Yes.
So that might escalate that time frame, but there would still need to be this one-year period of making sure everything's in place and that our members know what to expect and have a firm understanding of what this means and what it doesn't mean, because a lot of things are in the public arena that may or may not necessarily reflect what the waiver amendment is truly proposing.
Are the childless adults who could be subject to this, the conditional could, are they generally in the 19 to 34 age bracket, sir?
They're generally in the 19 to 50 age bracket.
And
that's about two-thirds of them.
Two-thirds of the
149.
What percentage of all 1.18 million recipients are 19 to 34 and 19 to 50?
A little tougher question. I'll just start with well over 400,000 are kids.
Oh, okay.
So you can just take over a third away right away.
Yep.
And beyond that, we could break it down for you anytime. But we know what this group is and to whom this applies. And it's not for our long-term care population for very obvious reasons.
Okay. Now let's play it out. If someone is asked to take a drug screen and or then a drug test and refuses and they're getting MA benefits, what happens to them?
They will then be ineligible for MA benefits for a period of up to 6 months. And then even if they are still refusing at that point, they will be able to re-enroll. So it's really a six-month maximum suspension as proposed under our amendments.
Would they be able to re-enroll if they pass both the drug screen and the drug test?
If they take the screening,
yes,
and the screening says you don't need a drug test, then they're back in.
Right.
If they take the screening and the screening says you need a drug test and they agree to take the drug test, they're back in. They can hop back in or choose to come back into the program anytime. They could refuse, and then 2 weeks later think about it again and decide to take the screening and or the test.
If they're cut off from benefits for 6 months and they again refuse to take the drug screen, do they again denied benefits for another 6 months?
That's not clear yet through the statutes or the rules from what we can ascertain, and that'll be part of the discussion with CMS.
Okay. Someone takes a drug screen and fails the drug test. What happens to them, sir?
If they fail the drug test but agree to treatment paid for by the Medicaid program, nothing different happens. They are still in the program.
They haven't missed a beat
of having benefits. If someone is testing positive, that is not the reason that they wouldn't be in the program. In fact, that's a good reason they should be in the program if they're eligible, so that they then can get the treatment paid for by the program. That's what this is really designed to do. So folks are focusing on some other aspects of it, but right. If a person takes the screening and takes the test, if it's indicated, and then the test says you have a problem,
yes,
the state will maintain benefits for that person as long as they're willing to go into treatment.
As long as they're willing to go into treatment.
Correct.
Who pays for the treatment?
The Medicaid program.
The Medicaid
not
program.
Not the member.
You've heard this argued on the floor of both the Senate and the Assembly. Democrats say it's cruel and punitive. Your response?
I categorically disagree with that. This is a population that is able-bodied, by all accounts, should be working if there are jobs available, and this state has made significant investments under Governor Walker's leadership and the legislature to make training and education available. So it's not cruel to help someone with a drug problem receive treatment for that problem at the Medicaid program's expense and then translate that into a family-sustaining job. So I think it's pretty straightforward, but obviously for political purposes it can be called something else.
If an MA recipient needs drug treatment, would she or he be able to get it in their community? Is that a condition of it, or would they have to commute or have to move somewhere else temporarily? Your thoughts on that?
Most of our members are in managed care programs within their communities, so they would probably be receiving it in their community just as they would any other aspect of their health care. And if treatment is not necessarily available or timely in that community, perhaps they would need to go a little further. But we anticipate it generally being where they are, with some limitations due to where the providers are and things of that nature. But we have that in a number of specialties already today in the medical field, so we don't view it as that different. But there's a heightened response when you mention drug problems, substance use disorder, and things of that nature.
Right.
So
Wisconsin would be first. Have any other states also planning to submit a similar waiver or already submitted it?
It's an interesting question. I was very recently, in the last week or two, at the National Association of Medicaid Directors meeting, and as you can imagine, Wisconsin suddenly is a little more interesting to some folks than it might ordinarily be. And a number of other states are planning to submit things of this nature. I think you've heard other governors around the country talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Some, quite frankly, may be waiting to see how CMS reacts to our request.
Okay.
And from our perspective, what works for this state may or may not work for another state, and that's part of the push for flexibility.
Have medical professionals estimated how many of the MA recipients who take a drug test might fail? Have you received any estimates on that?
We have not. And that's not the key question. The key question is, can we help them get treatment and into good paying jobs and truly move from dependence on government programs to independence?
Okay. Let's turn from the drug screening and testing to the work mandate. Is that the wrong term? How would that work? And again, are we talking about the same 149,000 childless adults?
Same population.
Okay. So how would you pick which of those or all of them have to either work or be in a job training program?
Essentially all of them, with some exceptions, again, like I mentioned before, if there are some extenuating circumstances, which we'll be discussing with CMS and some others, but we have those already in some of our public assistance programs. So if for some reason there's a unique situation, someone's unable to work, we will address those. But more broadly, yes, it will apply to that population, but to that same population.
All 149,000?
Minus the exemptions, yes.
Minus the exemptions. And how would the agency match make between someone and their potential work or job training? Or would workforce development do that?
Workforce development has a role in that, but a lot of these processes go through our income maintenance consortia, which is where our members often interact with the Medicaid program directly, where they're literally on the phone or online with someone helping them enroll or helping them with a form or something of that nature. And they will typically work through those income maintenance consortia, as well as some vendors who do help with placement in programs, education and training programs. So there will be avenues for our members to reach those programs. But it's also important to clarify that it's not simply you have to have a job. If you are training or receiving education for 80 hours a month, then you have fulfilled the requirement and your benefits will be maintained, no changes.
Either on the job or in job training, that's an important number, 80 hours per month?
Correct.
Okay.
Which matches some other programs we have in state government today.
And what about an MA recipient who doesn't respond to either work or job training?
They'll be given multiple opportunities to respond, but eventually it will be clear that that person has no interest or engagement in telling us why they can't, why they might be exempt, and at that point they will lose eligibility.
For how long?
6 months.
6 months. Mm-hmm. And at the end of 6 months?
They will be able to re-enroll.
If they agree to 80 hours?
That's going to be a component with CMS, but as of now, they likely would be able to re-enroll.
Okay. That'll be decided. That'll be decided by the waiver.
There are a few components that still aren't as clear-cut about when they would expire and things of that nature, and that's where the negotiation process with CMS comes into play.
Someone affected by the either job training or working 8 hours, would they be told this job exists at a convenience store or a retail, you must take it?
They will be helped to find a job. It may or may not become that specific. It may be more of a sector-based type of opportunity, but it could be a specific employer or location. If it's something available that's reasonable for that person to be employed by location and by skill set, then they do need to take advantage of that opportunity in order to stay on our program. It's important to focus that, again, these are able-bodied adults. These are folks who I haven't heard anyone argue should not be working. They should be working, and the state is here to try and help that along. If they're not willing, that's a different conversation. But the overwhelming majority of our members would prefer to be off of government assistance and in a good paying job and supporting themselves and those around them.
The opponents, again, you've heard this, say that there's an assumption that many MA recipients are abusing the program. Your response?
I don't base this on the assumptions that they're abusing the program or not abusing the program. If they're eligible, they are eligible under the rules we have today and under the laws we have today, both at the state and federal level. So we do pursue folks who clearly are defrauding the system, but that is not what we're talking about today. This is designed to move folks off of government dependence and into independence and to help them do it. So I understand the criticisms from both sides and the stereotypes of our members that many people make across the political spectrum. We don't view it in those contexts at all. There is no average Medicaid recipient. They all come from different walks of life, rural, urban. Perhaps they've been born into poverty. Perhaps something else happened in life where suddenly they were in poverty. We want to help them where they are, but help them move off of the programs because, again, this is the group that is able to move off of those programs.
Isn't there a third part of the component, a 48-month cutoff? Explain that to me. Who would be affected by that, sir?
Yes, there is a 48-month cutoff that we are applying for in the waiver amendment. So that clock would start once they've approved, presumably, the waiver amendment. So anyone who's been on the program for 3 years right now would not be coming in with only 1 year left of eligibility, so to speak. So, but the clock of 48 months never runs if you're getting an education or job training or working 80 hours per week and following the drug screening and drug testing and, if necessary, the treatment requirements. So we don't expect the 48 months to impact very many people because there are multiple opportunities to make that work for folks. And 4 years is a long time. And as we get 3 years into this, a few years from now, presumably, we'll have better mechanisms to inform our members that they're coming up upon these types of scenarios and doing our best to make sure they don't bump up against the 48 months. But in the end, if someone chooses to not pursue work or education drug screening, mm-hmm. then it'll be up to them if the 48 months applies to them.
But just to clarify, the 48 months would apply only again to the subset childless adults?
Everything
you're not talking about somebody long-term care.
No.
The 80-year-old in a nursing home would not be affected by the waiver.
The 80-year-old in the nursing home is not in this waiver whatsoever. It is strictly the 149,000 childless adults, ABODs as we call them, able-bodied adults without children. That's who it applies to. So I appreciate you emphasizing that, though, because that does get not necessarily represented as well as it should sometimes.
Well, there's a lot of potential fear out there on the part of parents who may have 80-year-olds in a nursing home. I'm intrigued. The budget amount for Medicaid last year hit $9 billion for the first time. Mm-hmm. 55% of that, or $5 billion, from the feds, 30% from state. Is this waiver expected to cut the cost or slow the increase in our MA program, Mike?
It should help slow the increase. When you have folks who have a substance use disorder problem, they are probably using our medical system quite a bit and probably not in the best ways. They're probably going to the emergency room, or worse, they're not getting any care at all, and in the end it ends very poorly for everyone involved. So it could reduce costs in that realm, and we would expect it to, because folks will be getting treatment and then will stabilize their medical situations and won't be using the system in ways that aren't optimal for their health or for the costs of the system, but their health is the primary concern.
The long-term cost, projected cost of MA, the previous secretary, who we all miss, called that unsustainable. Would you agree with that?
Well, when, may she rest in peace, when Kitty was talking about that, those numbers were unsustainable.
Are they still?
They are probably still, particularly when we anticipate federal action. Now, we did have a more positive budget in this regard with the governor's request that the Finance Committee acted on a couple of weeks ago for Medicaid, where the biennial increase, cost to continue, as we call it, was in the $300 million range, even a little less. And then the Finance Committee reduced that a little bit as well. We can talk about that another time. But that number was $1.8 billion when the governor took office, and then was probably in the six or eight hundreds, you know, in those middle budgets in between then and now. So it's back in the sort of manageable realm, but again, we're not changing the program and the costs keep going up, and that is something that has to be managed. And as you know, anything that costs money in the budget has an opportunity cost for anything else in the budget.
As you look long term, one in five Wisconsin residents are now receiving some type of Medicaid benefit. 5, 10, 15 years out, is this going to increase to one out of every two, out of every three? Long term look at MA program.
If you look at demographics in this state, we are getting a little older at a little faster pace than the rest of the country. So on the long term care side, just on the elderly side, it would go up just because of demographics. So that's a challenge that we will have moving forward. Now, some of that is 10 to 20 years out.
Yes.
But as we all know, time goes fast, and we need to prepare for those things 10 years ahead of time rather than wake up one day and wonder what happened.
The average MA recipient in Wisconsin, male, female, how old, and how long do they spend on the program, sir?
The average age, again, we don't view it that way. The long-term care population, for obvious reasons, is on it much longer. Mm-hmm. Some, unfortunately, due to their medical condition, their entire lives. The childless adult population, which we've been talking about primarily today, you'll hear the term churn. They will churn on and off the program. If you look at our 48-month eligibility time limit that we discussed a minute ago, many wouldn't see that as an impact because typically folks are not on even that long. So it really shouldn't impact very many folks. But Medicaid is a diverse program, and I don't think it gets the the notoriety it should for that characteristic.
In the minutes we have left, let's talk about some potential changes to Medicaid driven by Washington. Washington, which pays 55% of our MA costs. The U.S. House passed a bill that would, well, according to the, quoting here from the statement from the Wisconsin Hospital Association, Wisconsin would get $37 billion less under the House-approved Health Care Act than had Wisconsin expanded Medicaid. Now, let's be fair, $37 billion less through 2025. Is that an accurate number? Is that an accurate characterization?
It's a reasonable characterization. We haven't hired a statistician to analyze their statistical methodology, as you could understand. But it illustrates a point that those who didn't take the expansion, and in this state for very good reasons, may have some different challenges going forward. And what you're seeing is folks who have strong interest in the program, like our providers, and validly so, have some concerns about that. And it goes back to your question about sustainability and things of that nature. So it's a real concern, but at the same time, Wisconsin, unlike many other states, has built a sustainable model that we've had now for a few years. We continue to fund it at a decreasing level, fortunately, meaning our costs to continue are going down, as I illustrated, meaning the increase is going down. And it's working for this state. We cover everyone who is at the poverty level or below. And then those who are a little above that or way above that are in the private market, whether it's on the federally facilitated exchange or just in our average commercial market here in the state, which is reasonably vibrant compared to other states.
So the Hospital Association statement basically asks this question: did the House-passed bill treat Wisconsin fairly?
You know, fair or unfair, it treats us in a reasonable way that lets us continue our program. A per cap environment, which is the key issue here, as well as some reductions in funding.
Yes.
That is treating everyone similarly. Now, we can discuss where is our baseline for that spending number and things of that nature. And those are things that we are continuing to discuss with our delegation in Washington so that we aren't unfairly disadvantaged. But, you know, every state has its own perspectives on the legislation. And we will continue to advocate ours. We want to ensure that we can maintain our program in the long term, not under what the Affordable Care Act was requiring. Now remember, the governor did want to expand to 100% under the Affordable Care Act. CMS at that time, under the Obama administration, said no, it's 138 or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So
we
that,
went to 138.
That was the height of inflexibility imposed by the federal government. That model wasn't appropriate for Wisconsin. We built one that is.
The projections, the numbers that you've seen, $850 billion Medicaid cut over 10 years, would that, if that became law, would that force Wisconsin to not offer MA benefits to as many of its citizens?
It's hard to speculate on that because the healthcare system, the world of healthcare, is changing so significantly all the time.
Yeah.
Some of that reinforced by the Affordable Care Act, but there are different models of care that are developing all of the time. Our payment systems are evolving, so I won't minimize that it would be less money and would be a challenge, but it's very speculative to say that that would suddenly mean certain things and certain negative things to our population 10 years from now.
Okay. Final question is this. Let's summarize it this way. First of all, we're talking about childless adults. That's 149,000 of our caseload of 1.187 million. So that's a subset. Then the reason to seek the waiver for drug screen, drug test, and the work, either job training or on the job, overall, the reasons for that, summarize it. Why is Wisconsin seeking the waiver?
Wisconsin is seeking this waiver because that population is able-bodied and should be working. And Wisconsin, through this waiver amendment, is going to try and help them achieve that status. So it'll start with the screening, perhaps testing if necessary, and then treatment paid for by the Medicaid program to help folks, if they have a substance use disorder problem, receive the treatment they need and get back into the workforce. And as the governor says, public assistance is not a hammock, it's a trampoline. And this would put folks back in the working world, supporting themselves and those around them in a positive way. in a self-sustaining way. And just, so we view it as a positive.
Just to be clear, the person watching this whose mother or father may be on long-term care, not affected by these, by the waiver, correct?
That is correct. This is for childless adults only. It is not impacting the long-term care population. I appreciate you emphasizing that. I answer that sometimes within my own realm in my personal life as well. I can relate to this very well, but this is clearly only for that subset of our population that is able to work and should be working.
Michael Heifetz, Medicaid Director for the State Department of Health Services, thanks very much for answering these very important questions.
Thanks. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.